and did not stir. Yes, what all did she not hear, and how impressively delivered, in these hours! What tales they were! The 14 years' service in the land of mud and gold unrolled before her, and then the extra years that made them 25, and how the wrong one and the right one and their handmaidens together assembled the 11, including the charming one. Of the flight together she heard, of Laban's pursuit and search, of the wrestling with the ox-eyed one till the dawn, from which Jacob all his life limped like a smith, of Shechem and its abominations, when the savage twins strangled the bridegroom and destroyed the cattle and were cursed, up to a point, of Rachel's dying a furlong only from the inn, and of the little son of death, of Reuben's irresponsible shooting away, and how he too was cursed, in so far as Israel can be cursed, and then the story of Joseph, how the father had loved him sore, but strong of soul and heroic in God, had sent him forth, and knowingly given the best beloved a sacrifice. This, once on a time, was still fresh, and Jacob's voice shook, whereas in the earlier ones, already overlaid with years, it had been epically unmoved, solemn and blithe of word and tone, even in the grim and heavy, heavy parts, for these were all God's stories, sacred in the telling. But it is quite certain now, could not be otherwise, and must be conceded, that Tamar's listening soul, in the course of instruction, was fed not alone on historical, time-overlaid, once on a time, the time-honored once, but with one day as well. And one day is a word of scope. It has two faces. It looks back into solemnly twilight distances, and it looks forwards, far, far forwards into space, and is not less solemn because it deals with the to-be than that other dealing with the has-been. Many deny this. To them, the one day of the past is the only holy one. That of the future, they account trifling. They are pious in quotes, not pious, fools and clouded souls. Jacob sat not in their church. Who honors not the future one day, to him the past has had naught to say, and even the present he fronts the wrong way. Such is our creed, if we may interpolate it into the teachings which Jacob ben Yitzchak imparted to Tamar. Teachings full of the double-faced one day. And why not, since he was telling her the world, and that is one day in both senses, of knowledge and of foreknowledge? Well might she gratefully say to him, as she did, "You have paid too little heed, my master and lord, to telling me what has come to pass, but spoken ever to thy handmaiden of the far future." For so he had done, quite unconsciously, since into all his stories of the beginning there came an element of promise, so that one could not tell them without foretelling. Of what did he speak to her? He spoke of Shiloh. The assumption would be entirely wrong that it was only upon his deathbed, feeling the promptings of oncoming dissolution, that Jacob spoke of Shiloh the hero. In that moment he had no promptings at all, merely pronouncing the long-known and prepared words, having considered and conned them half his life long, so that his dying hour could only confer on them an added solemnity. I mean the blessing and cursing judgments upon his sons, and the reference to the figure of the promise, whom he called Shiloh. It had occupied Jacob's thoughts even in Tamar's time, and even though he spoke of it to nobody but her, and then out of gratitude for her great attentiveness, and because, with the remnant of his power of feeling, he was a little in love with her. Strange indeed and extraordinary how he had mused it all out to himself. For Shiloh was really nothing but a place name, the name of a walled settlement in the country farther north, where often the children of the land, when they had fought and come off victors, would gather to divide the spoil. Not a particularly sacred place, but it was called Place of Quiet or Rest, for that is what Shiloh means. It signifies peace, signifies drawing a long and relieved breath after bloody feud. It is a blessing word, as proper for a person as for a place. Sychem, son of the citadel, had had the same name as his city, and in the same way Shiloh might serve for a man, and son of man called bearer and bringer of peace. In Jacob's thoughts, he was the man of expectation, promised in those earliest and ever-renewed vows and precepts, promised to the womb of the woman, promised in Noah's blessing on Shem, promised to Abraham, through whose seed all the breeds on the earth should be blessed. The Prince of Peace and the Anointed, who should reign from sea to sea and from river to river to the end of the world, to whom all kings should bow, and all the peoples cleave to the hero who one day should be awoken out of the chosen seed, and to whom the seed of his kingdom should be confirmed forever. Him who would then come he called Shiloh. And now we are challenged to use our imagination as well as we can, and picture to ourselves how the old man, endowed with such rich gifts of expression and impressiveness, spoke to Tamar of Shiloh in these hours, and bound up the earliest beginning with the furthest future. His language was powerful. It was weighty with meaning. Tamar, the female, the single soul deemed worthy to hear it, sat motionless. Even watching very closely, you could not be sure of even the slightest swaying of her earrings. She heard the world, which in the early things hid promise of the late, a vast, ever-branching, eventful history, through which ran the scarlet thread of promise and expectancy from one day to one day, from the earliest one day to the furthest future one. On that one day, in a cosmic catastrophe of salvation, two stars which flamed in wrath against each other, the star of might and the star of right, would rush upon each other in consummating thunder crash to be henceforward one, and shine with mild and mighty radiance forever on the heads of men, the star of peace. That was Shiloh's star, star of the Son of Man, the Son of the Election, who was promised to the seed of the woman that he should tread the serpent underfoot. Now Tamar was a woman. She was the woman, for every woman is the woman, instrument of the fall and womb of salvation, Astarte and the mother of God. And at the feet of the father man she sat, on whom at a confirming nod the blessing had fallen, and who should pass it on in history to one in Israel. Who was it? Above whose brow would the father lift up his horn that he anoint him as his heir? Tamar had fingers whereon to reckon it up. Three of the sons had been cursed. The favored, son of the true wife, was dead. Not love could guide the course of inheritance, and where love has gone, nothing but justice remains. Justice was the horn out of which the oil of anointing must trickle on the brow of the fourth. Judah, he was the heir. The Resolute One. From now on, the standing furrows between Tamar's brows took on yet another meaning. Not only of anger against her beauty they spoke, of searching and strain, but also of determination. Here let me impress upon you, Tamar had made up her mind, cost what it might, by dint of her womanhood, to squeeze herself into the history of the world. So ambitious she was. In this inexorable and almost sinister resolve, there is about the inexorable always something sinister, her spiritual aspirations had issued. There are natures wherein teaching is straightway converted into resolve. Indeed, they only seek instruction in order to feed their willpower and give it an aim. Tamar had needed only to be instructed about the world and its striving toward its goal to arrive at the unconditional resolve to mingle her womanhood with these strivings and to become historic. Let me be clear. Everybody has a place in the history of the world. Simply to be born into it, one must, one way or the other, and roughly speaking, contribute by one's little span, one's mite to the whole of the world span. Most of us, however, swarm in the periphery, far off to one side, unaware of the world history, unsharing in it, modest, and at bottom not displeased at not belonging to its illustrious dramatis personae. For such an attitude, Tamar had only contempt. Scarcely had she received instruction when she resolved and willed. Or, better put, she had taken instruction to learn what it was she willed and did not will, and she made up her mind to put herself in line, into the line of the promise. She wanted to be of the family, to shove herself and her womb into the course of history, which led through time to salvation. She was the woman. The dispensation had come to her seed. She would be the foremother of Shiloh, no more and no less. Firm stood the folds between her velvet brows. They already meant three things. They could not fail to mean yet a fourth. They came to mean anger and envious scorn for Shua's daughter, Jehuda's wife. This jade was already in the line. She had a privileged place, and that without merit, knowledge, or willpower, for Tamar counted these as merits. She was a cipher dignified by history. Tamar bore her ill will. She hated her, quite consciously and most femininely. She would have, equally open-eyed, wished for her death, if that had had any sense. But it had none, because the woman had already borne three sons to Judah, so that Tamar would have had to wish all three of them dead, too, to have things put back and a free place made for herself at the side of the inheritor of the blessing. It was in this character that she loved Judah and desired him. Her love was ambition. Probably never, or never up till then, did a woman love and desire a man so entirely apart from his own sake, and so entirely for the sake of an idea, as Tamar loved Judah. It was a new basis for love, for the first time in existence. Love which comes not from the flesh, but from the idea, so that one might well call it demonic, as we did the unrest which Tamar herself evoked in men, aside from her fleshly form. She could have got at Judah with her Astarte side, and would probably have been pleased to do so, for she knew him much too well as slave to the mistress not to be sure of success. But it was too late, which always means too late in time. She came too late. Her ambition love was in the wrong time-place. She could no longer shove herself in at this link in the chain and put herself into the line. So she would have to take a step forward or else back in time and the generations. She would have to change her own generation and address her ambitious designs to the point where she would have preferred to be mother. The idea was not a difficult one, for in the highest sphere, mother and beloved had always been one. In short, she would have to avert her gaze from Judah and direct it upon his sons, the grandsons of the inheritance, whom, under other circumstances, she could almost have wished out of the way in order to bear them again herself to better purpose. And first, of course, she directed it solely upon the boy Ur, he being the heir. Her personal position in time made the descent quite possible. She would not have been much too young for Judah, and for Ur not entirely too old. Still, she took the step without joy. She was put off by the sickliness and degeneracy of the brothers, no matter how much charm they had. But her ambition came to her aid, and luckily, for otherwise she would have found it inadequate. Ambition told her that the promise did not always take the promising or even the suitable course, that it might run through a great deal that was dubious or worthless or even depraved without exhausting itself, that disease did not always come of disease, but that it can issue in tested and developed strength and continue on the way of salvation, especially when brought out and developed by dint of such a resolute will as Tamar called her own. Besides, the scions of Judah were just degenerate males, just that. It depended on the female, on the right person coming in at the weak point. The first promise had to do with the womb of the woman. What, in fact, had the men got to do with it? So then, to reach her goal, she had to rise in time to the third generation. Otherwise, the thing was not possible. She did indeed practice her Astarte wiles on the young man, but his response was both childish and vicious. Ur only wanted to sport with her, and when she set the darkness of her brows against him, he fell away and was incapable of being serious. A certain delicacy restrained her from going further up and working on Judah, for it had been he whom she actually wanted, or would have wanted, and though he did not know that, yet she did, and was ashamed to beg from him the son whom she would gladly have borne him. Therefore she got behind the head of the tribe, her master Jacob, and worked on his dignified weakness for her, of which she was fully aware, of course, and more flattered than wounded it by wooing for admission and desiring from him his grandson for her husband. They sat in the tent, on the very spot where Joseph had once talked the old man out of the many-colored coat. Her task was easier than his. "Master and Lord," she said, "little father, dear and great, hear now thy handmaid, and incline thine ear to her prayer and her earnest and yearning desire. Lo, thou hast made me distinguished and great before the daughters of the land, hast instructed me in the world and in God, the only highest, hast opened my eyes and taught me so that I am thy creation. But how has this been vouchsafed to me that I found favor in thine eyes, and thou hast comforted me and spoken to thy handmaid with kindness, which may the Lord requite thee, and may thy reward be perfect in the God of Israel, to whom I have come by thy hand, so that I have safety beneath his wings. For I guard myself and keep well my soul, that I forget not the tales which you have made me see, and that they shall not come away from my heart as long as I live. My children and my children's children, if God give me such, them will I tell, that they destroy themselves not, nor make themselves any image like unto man, nor woman, nor cattle on earth, or birds beneath the sky, or reptiles, or fishes, nor that they shall lift up their eyes and see the sun, the moon, and the stars, and fall away from me to worship them. Thy people are my people, and thy God my God. So if he give me children, they shall not come to me from a man of a strange people. It may not be. A man from out of thy house, my lord, perchance may take a daughter of the land such as I was, and lead her to God. But I, as I now am, new-born, and thine image, cannot be bride to an uninstructed one, and who prays to images of wood and stone from the hand of the artificer, which can neither hear, nor see, nor smell. Behold now, Father and Lord, what thou hast done in shaping me, that thou hast made me fine and delicate of soul, so that I cannot live like the hosts of the ignorant, and wed the first wooer, and give my womanhood to a god-fool, as once in my simplicity I should have done. These now are the drawbacks of refinement, and the hardships that elevation brings in its train. Therefore reckon it not to thy daughter and handmaid for a naughtiness, if she point out the responsibility thou hast taken on thyself when thou didst form her, and how thou standest now in her debt, almost as much as she in thine, since thou must now pay for her having been lifted up.